Epilogue. Terror, as a strategy, rarely succeeds, except in one respect. It creates repression on the part of the state or the occupying power. This is an expected and longed-for goal of terrorists who seek to counter the state's vast military advantage by forcing it to overreact, generating popular support for their cause. Fighting terror is an expensive and clumsy enterprise. Great powers have often been humbled by small, highly motivated groups that are willing to kill and willing to die, as France learned in Algeria and Britain in Palestine. Osama bin Laden was deliberately provoking the United States in his attacks on the American embassies in East Africa in 1998. The USS Cole in Yemen in 2000, and mainland America on 9/11. He wanted the United States to invade Afghanistan, believing that America would suffer the same fate as the Soviet Union, which simply dissolved after its withdrawal in 1988. Bin Laden took credit for that. He imagined that America would bankrupt itself and alienate Muslims everywhere in its pursuit of the war on terror. Eventually, the United States would also become disunited states, thus opening the road for Islam to regain its rightful place as the world's only superpower. Bin Laden miscalculated, but he didn't entirely fail. Even though the core organization of Al-Qaeda has been devastated by American and Allied strikes, Bin Laden's progeny have spread through the Middle East, Africa, and South Asia, controlling far more territory in the aggregate than at any time before 9/11. Moreover, the goals of Al-Qaeda's savage offspring have expanded far beyond what the founder envisioned. They seek a civil war within Islam, the annihilation of the Shiites, and the conquest of all peoples who do not believe in their literalist reading of their religion. All of that is seen as a prelude for the end of time. It's common to suggest that dealing with root causes of terrorism is the best and maybe only way to bring it to an end, but there is very little evidence to support that notion, or indeed what those root causes are. Poverty doesn't necessarily lead to acts of terror, nor does tyranny. Nor do wars, corruption, a lack of education or opportunity, physical abuse, ethnic hatred, food insecurity, political instability, gender apartheid, a feeble civil society, a muzzled press, nor an absence of democracy. Not one of these factors by itself is sufficient to say that here at last is the reason that idealistic young people line up for the opportunity to behead their opponents or blow themselves up in a fruit market. But each of them is a tributary in a mighty river that floods the Middle East, a river that we can call despair. Yes, there is an absolute relationship between poverty, education, and violence, but it often works in the reverse of what is commonly assumed. Palestinians who are involved in terror organizations, such as Hamas and Hezbollah, tend to have better educations, are more likely to be employed, and have higher incomes than the general population. The worst violence in the occupied territories often occurs in times of relative prosperity. Game theorists have discovered that improving economies may actually lead to increased acts of terror, perhaps because the targets are richer. And as for the absence of democracy, America's experience in overthrowing tyrants in Iraq and Libya and attempting to bring pluralistic rule to the Middle East should be a sufficient caution about applying such remedies in the future. And yet all terrorist groups eventually die out. Audrey Kurth Cronin, a professor of public policy at George Mason University, and the author of an insightful book, How Terrorism Ends, studied 475 groups that met her elemental definition of terrorist organizations. They deliberately targeted non-combatants in a series of attacks. She found that the average lifespan of such groups was 8 years. Al-Qaeda, having been founded in 1988, has far outlasted its life expectancy, although religiously based terror groups tend to be more durable than average. One such group, the Hindu Thugs, lasted 600 years. Professor Cronin outlines 6 ways terrorist organizations come to an end. The first is the elimination of the charismatic figure, usually at the head of such groups. This worked exceptionally well with the 1992 capture of Abimael Guzman, the leader of Peru's Sendero Luminoso, the Shining Path, one of the most lethal groups of the 20th century. Nearly 70,000 people were killed in the struggle between Guzman's organization and the Peruvian government. Similarly, the arrest of Shoko Asahara, the blind yogi who founded the Japanese doomsday cult Aum Shinrikyo, Supreme Truth, which was responsible for the sarin gas attacks on Tokyo subways in 1995, effectively ended an organization that could have been more dangerous than Al-Qaeda, given the skill and ambition of its membership. On the other hand, the targeting of Palestinian terror chieftains by Israel failed to reduce violence, and actually boosted recruitment by those groups. The killing of bin Laden by American Special Forces in 2011 has had a mixed legacy. His successor, Ayman al-Zawahiri, enjoys none of the magnetism that bin Laden exerted on his followers, and even though 75% of the core al-Qaeda organization has been killed by drone attacks or raids, it is still capable of inspiring kindred groups to follow its example. Terror sometimes ends in negotiations. In other words, terrorists enter a legitimate political process. No one likes to talk to terrorists, nor do terrorists like to talk, which is why there are so few examples of successful compromises that lead to the end of violence. The Good Friday Agreement of April 10, 1998, effectively did so by compelling the paramilitary groups in Northern Ireland to surrender their weapons and commit to peaceful and democratic means of resolving differences. The conflict between the Colombian government and the narco-trafficking mafia FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, which has cost nearly 250,000 lives over half a century, may be another example, if the agreement announced in September 2015 endures. It is the nature of organizations, even ones based on terror, to adjust their mission if circumstances undermine their reason for existence. When bin Laden created Al-Qaeda, he envisioned it as an anti-communist Muslim foreign legion, a potential ally of the West, just as the Mujahideen in Afghanistan had been in their war against the Soviets. Even before bin Laden's death, Al-Qaeda had turned into an anti-Western Islamist fantasy with unrealizable utopian goals. The core Al-Qaeda organization wouldn't know how to negotiate because it doesn't know what it wants. It's a myth that terrorism never succeeds, although Professor Cronin found that only about 5% of the groups she studied achieved their goals. Most of them were movements associated with the so-called wars of liberation against colonial powers, as in Ireland, Cyprus, Vietnam, and Algeria. The prototype of the successful terrorist organization is Irgun, the Jewish group headed by Menachem Begin in the British Mandate of Palestine. Begin improvised many of the theatrical, headline-grabbing actions that demoralized the British public and led to the government's decision to turn over control of Palestine to the United Nations in 1948. That same year, Begin's irregulars attacked a peaceful Palestinian village, Deir Yassin. His men went house to house, hurling hand grenades through the windows and shooting villagers who attempted to flee. Within 2 months of Deir Yassin, about 350,000 Palestinians had fled or been chased into neighboring countries, a total that would eventually reach as many as 750,000. Irgun's success would spawn many imitators, notably among those same Palestinian refugees. Ukonto Wesizwe, Spear of the Nation, the armed wing of the African National Congress, was directly fashioned after Irgun, according to its co-founder Nelson Mandela, in order to wage a terrorist campaign against the white apartheid regime in South Africa. Beginning with acts of sabotage against the government, the campaign eventually turned to bombings of bars, banks, supermarkets, and stadiums, as well as torture and murder. The ANC renounced violence in 1990 when it entered negotiations with the governing White Party, and then came to power 4 years later. Terrorism was not the central element in eliminating apartheid, but it was certainly a contributor. When American soldiers entered Afghanistan after 9/11, they found a copy of Begin's memoir, The Revolt, in the library of an Al-Qaeda training camp. Bruce Hoffman, the director of the Center for Security Studies at Georgetown University and the dean of counterterrorism scholarship, speculates that bin Laden was studying Begin's transition from terrorist leader to statesman. Begin later became Israel's prime minister and won the Nobel Peace Prize following the signing of the Camp David Accords in 1979. Most terror organizations simply end in failure. Internal schisms may cause the group to implode. Sometimes the ideological rationale behind the movement becomes irrelevant, as happened with Marxist-based terror organizations after the fall of the Soviet Union. Any remnant of popular support can wither in the face of widespread revulsion if the terror crosses an emotional line. That was the cause of the collapse of the Islamic group in Egypt after the 1997 Luxor massacre. Similarly, many of bin Laden's inner circle decried 9/11 as a catastrophe for their group, observing that instead of driving the West out of the Middle East, Al-Qaeda attacks prompted two wars that drew the United States and other Western powers much more deeply into the region. Repression is the way that governments routinely attempt to stamp out terror organizations, but it requires a rapacity and persistence that democratic countries find difficult to justify or sustain. A combination of repression and internal division brought an end to Zawahiri's al-Jihad group in Egypt. Russia crushed the Chechen separatist movement, which gave up armed resistance in 2009. However, hundreds of Chechens have joined the Islamist ranks in Syria and may pose a real threat to Russia if and when they return. When Israel invaded Lebanon in 1982 in order to root out the Palestinian Liberation Organization, Prime Minister Menachem Begin thought that the operation would last 48 hours. In fact, it continued for 18 years. Israel finally succeeded in expelling the PLO, but the political vacuum was filled by Hezbollah, which was formed with Iranian assistance in reaction to the invasion. Hezbollah now controls Lebanon. The last of Professor Cronin's categories for how terrorist groups end is reorientation, that is, the transition of the group from terror into something else, usually crime. But volatile organizations can move in multiple directions. The Philippine Islamist group Abu Sayyaf began as a separatist organization, became a criminal enterprise, and has since pledged allegiance to the Islamic State. Judging the future of Al-Qaeda through the lenses of these six categories, we can say that decapitation has had an effect, although it has not proved fatal. Negotiation will not be a factor with the core organization. Success is out of reach, and failure is a real possibility, especially with the rise of vigorous competitors. Repression, in the form of military action, will continue to erode the ability of Al-Qaeda to act. Reorientation is unlikely. ISIS, or the Islamic State, has been a different organization since its beginning in 1999, when a thuggish but charismatic Jordanian ex-convict, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, arrived in Kandahar, Afghanistan, seeking to join Al-Qaeda. Bin Laden didn't accept him at the time. However, he did underwrite a training camp for Zarqawi, who recruited mostly from Jordan, the Palestinian territories, Syria, and Lebanon. This region is known in Arabic as Al-Sham, loosely translated into English as the Levant. Thus, the organization that Zarqawi later founded would come to be called either the Islamic State in Al-Sham, ISIS, or in the Levant, ISIL. Judged by Professor Cronin's schemata, one possible end to ISIS terrorism is success. Zarqawi was killed in 2006 by an American airstrike, and yet his organization survived the loss of its leader. It is already the richest terror group in history, raking in revenue from taxes, oil, ransoms, the black market in antiquities, and even traffic fines and the sale of fishing licenses. It is not even proper now to call it a terrorist group. It is a proto-state that uses terror not just to conquer, but to rule. And yet a state requires governance, which Islamists have never done well, and the actual control of territory, which opens the door to conventional warfare, where terrorists are at a decided disadvantage. Bin Laden never saw Iraq as a prosperous place to wage jihad, because the population is 65% Shiite. Although Al-Qaeda is an entirely Sunni organization, Bin Laden had no interest in creating a civil war inside Islam. That was exactly what attracted Zarqawi, believing that slaughtering other Muslims was the only way of purifying the religion. Someone may say that, in this matter, we are being hasty and rash by leading Muslims into a fratricidal battle that will be revolting and in which blood will be spilled, Zarqawi admitted in a letter to Bin Laden. This is exactly what we want. Both Bin Laden and Zarqawi dreamed of the restoration of the caliphate, which they expected would bring back the golden age of Islam, when it reached from Morocco to southern China, ruled over Spain, and went as far as the gates of Vienna. But for Bin Laden, the caliphate lay far over the horizon. His first priority was to unite the Muslims in the struggle against the West. By contrast, Zarqawi's goals were to set Muslims against each other, acquire territory, and declare the caliphate as soon as possible. The U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003 let loose a flood of end-time thinking among Muslims. As in Christianity and Judaism, more educated believers tend to hold themselves somewhat apart from such beliefs. This was certainly true of the elite leaders of Al-Qaeda, for whom the apocalypse was a distant, if longed-for, inevitability. The Iraq War changed that, setting loose a cascade of prophecies that threw the Sunni world into panic and confusion, but also thrilled those who imagined a glorious final act. Zarqawi, a man of the streets and the jail cell, gave focus to the radicalized Muslims, who were reminded of the sayings of the Prophet, that in the end time, believers are supposed to gather in Syria and Iraq to await the Day of Judgment. According to prophecy, Jesus will return to fight with the Muslims against the Jews, who will be led by the Antichrist, called the Deceiving Messiah in Islam. That final battle will take place in Dabiq, a small Syrian village near the Turkish border. Zarqawi and his successors were in a hurry to establish the caliphate, to prepare for that fateful hour. "We will not lay down this flag until we present it to Jesus, the son of Mariam, and the last of us fights the deceiver," an ISIS spokesman declared in 2013. Titanic upheavals convulsed the region in the very places mentioned by the prophecies. William McCants notes in his excellent study of jihadi thinking, The ISIS Apocalypse, "Sunnis and Shia are at war, both appealing to their own versions of prophecies to justify their politics." He concludes, "This is not bin Laden's apocalypse. The conflict that the Islamic State has provoked will ultimately bring about its destruction, but not without much more havoc and heartache. It is the belief of the leaders of that organization that chaos, conflict, and despair are their allies, and to some extent I agree with them. I have a theory, not verified by scholarship, that it is a feature of human nature to want to equalize one's inner and outer worlds. A child brought up in an abusive family is more likely to become abusive as an adult. Imagine the effect of the trauma and barbarism that has been visited on the Middle East and North Africa at large. Surely out of such environments emerge individuals who want to extend the chaos and make the rest of the world resemble the emotional state they are experiencing. This would account for at least some of the lure of the Islamic State, for shattered young people with few prospects of a fulfilling life. But it also reflects on the idealists, such as James Foley, Stephen Sotloff, Peter Kassig, and Kayla Mueller, who enjoyed an abundance of love and security in their own lives and devoted themselves to trying to extend those blessings to those who have not. It is to them this book is dedicated. At this writing, nearly 5 million Syrians have fled their country, half into Turkey. About 1 million are in Lebanon, where they account for 1 out of 4 residents in that fragile country. Nearly 700,000 are in Jordan. This does not count the 8 million Syrians who have been driven from their homes but still remain in their homeland. Half of the population has been uprooted. They join refugees from other areas of conflict, Afghanistan, Iraq, Sudan, Congo, Myanmar, Somalia, who make up the masses trying to enter Europe every day. Many perish trying, a testament to their desperation. Refugees are different from other immigrants. They typically arrive with nothing more than they can carry, except for an immense burden of trauma. They will provide a reservoir of young workers badly needed in Europe and a degree of cultural diversity that may enliven European societies. But if neglected or made to feel unwelcome, they may form a resentful underclass that will become a dangerous repository for radicalism. One can look at France for an example of a society that has failed to integrate its Muslim population, largely a residue of its colonial experience in North Africa. The U.S. State Department estimates that 10% of the French population is Muslim. French census forbids taking religion into account. And yet, Muslims account for approximately 70% of the prisoners in France. What a stark measure of the alienation that Muslims feel. America has been comparatively fortunate with its Muslim population, which enjoys about the same income, is about as likely to go to college or graduate school, and is less likely to go to prison than the average American. Moreover, America has largely benefited from great streams of refugees in recent history. In 1975, at the end of the Vietnam War, the United States evacuated 130,000 Vietnamese, many of them military officers and political leaders. That was followed by the wave of boat people in 1979, when hundreds of thousands fled, many to the United States. There are now more than 1 million Vietnamese in the United States, enjoying a higher average income than the general American population. Again, in 1980, there was the Mariel boat lift, when the Cuban government briefly allowed its citizens to emigrate. Between April and October, 125,000 people arrived in Florida, mostly by boat, to Key West and Miami. They included several thousand violent criminals and mentally unstable people that President Fidel Castro had mischievously tossed into the mix. Half of the immigrants settled in Miami, where they were quickly absorbed into the local economy. Among them, unsurprisingly, were several murderers and a number of gang members, but there were also a future Pulitzer Prize author, a soap opera star, and a major league ball player. The lesson seems to be that America does a good job of absorbing large numbers of refugees, even with very difficult populations. But there are also significant risks. And yet, if the world does little and fails to deal with this historic tide of refugees, there will be woeful consequences for decades to come. One day, in 1965, I took a date to the airport. I was a senior in high school in Dallas, Texas, and didn't have enough allowance to go to the movies. Love Field, as it is actually called, was a common destination for cheap dates. An American Airlines jetliner had just arrived from some exotic locale, Paris, we supposed, and my girlfriend and I walked out on the tarmac and climbed the ramp into the plane. The flight attendants were cleaning up as we sat in the first-class cabin. One of them actually gave us a snack. After that, we went into the FAA tower. "Come on in, kids," a flight controller said as I cracked open the unlocked door. We sat on stools and watched the landing lights of the incoming flights, like fireflies in the summer night. That America is gone. Terrorism killed it. That America is not remembered or even imagined by younger people who have never experienced such freedom, and who have no way of calculating the many sacrifices of liberty that have been made in the name of the war on terror. This age of terror will end one day. But whether our society can restore the feeling of freedom that once was our birthright is hard to predict. The security state that has grown up since 9/11 has transformed our culture. And yes, we have needed the protection. We are often reminded that we must never forget what happened on that fateful day. But if we fail to keep in mind the country we were before 9/11, we may never steer in that direction again. In that case, the terrorists really will have won. This is John H. Mayer. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Terror Years, From Al-Qaeda to the Islamic State, by Lawrence Wright. This program was directed by Christina Rooney. Executive producer, Kelly Gilday. Text copyright 2016 by Lawrence Wright. Production copyright 2016, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.